Welcome to This Is Money podcast, sponsored by Charles Stanley Direct. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me in Simon Lambert today is Lee Boyce. And coming up, 1 year of your money under Labour. We run the rule over the party's first 12 months in power, the good, the bad, and the ugly. We'll discuss what now looks to be an inevitable cut to the cash ISA limit. We ponder whether and what tax rises are on the way, look at the IFS's plans to sort out the state pension, and uncover what is putting off people from buying your home. Don't forget you stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach, or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.
But first, tax hikes, U-turns, tears in the chamber. Just how is Labour doing when it comes to our money after 12 months in power? The headlines haven't been favourable of late, but has it really all been that bad? Lee, Simon, welcome. A year of Labour. How have they done? Assess them. Mark the scorecard.
I guess that what we should do is we should start out by saying what they said they were going to do. They were going to end the chaos. They were going to bring back growth. And they were going to help us basically build Britain better. I'm not sure those objectives have been achieved in the first year in charge. And it was very unfortunate timing that as they arrived at the anniversary of being in charge, they had a week of what looked like chaos. Now, what I would say, and I know that I've been criticised by listeners in the past who felt I've been too harsh on Labour, is this is not a pro-Tory stance and an anti-Labour stance. Mm-hmm. This is a pro-competence and doing what is right stance. Frankly, the rot started a long time ago with the Conservative Party. We had a succession of chancellors who did bad jobs. Jeremy Hunt, for example, slashing the capital gains tax allowance, slashing the dividend allowance, freezing tax thresholds, refusing to do anything about things like the 60% tax trap, failing to actually sort out the child benefit trap before they left office. And bear in mind, the Tories knew that they were out the door. Like there was no way they were going to continue to be in charge. And yet Jeremy Hunt staged an attack on savers and investors that in a conversation with our veteran personal finance expert, Jeff Prestridge, the other day, Jeff said it could have come straight out of the Corbyn manifesto. I mean, and actually there were bits in the Corbyn manifesto about changing capital gains tax that were more generous than what Jeremy Hunt did with the allowances. So, you know, you have to set it against that backdrop. And the mistake I think that we made of trying to claw back all the money from COVID too quickly, right? So we made that mistake of doing policy by ticking boxes in spreadsheets, trying to meet fiscal rules at the expense of doing what's right. Now, I must admit, I hoped that Rachel Reeves would come in as Chancellor and correct all that. I think there was a golden opportunity to come in and go, look, these are the things that's wrong. You know, we've got a cottage industry of people earning over £100,000 a year trying to earn less money. We've got a cottage industry further down the scale of people trying to earn less money with a child benefit tax trap. We've frozen tax thresholds. You know, there was used to be a principle in the tax system that tax thresholds should always rise with inflation because it was wrong to basically drag people in due to the rising cost of living, and that we needed to have a kind of honest conversation about how we were going to also then pay for the things that we need to do, because these things had stopped being fiscal drag and started being anti-growth and holding the economy back. And if you look at what some of the expert economists, for example, the IFS says basically we need to raise the basic rate of income tax because we've shifted the burden so much onto higher earners, Now, higher earners have the broader shoulders and they should pay more tax. But we've shifted it so much onto them that we just can't really squeeze them anymore. And actually, if we want these things, we need to be a bit more honest and we need to shift the burden more onto basic rate taxpayers. Instead, what Jeremy Hunt did was he did two cuts to national insurance. Really, we couldn't afford to do either of those, and we definitely couldn't afford to do the second one. And I think that was reckless, to be honest. For a very cautious chancellor, that was a very reckless move. Unfortunately, the list of, and it being a financial podcast, I will focus on the financial stuff, and I don't want to give Rachel Reeves a kicking in a week that she's obviously had a really, really bad week. Keir Starmer's been behind every single one of these decisions, and he needs to own them.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right.
She has been unlucky. Rachel Reeves has been unlucky. Circumstances have not been favourable to her, you know, ranging from the shift in interest rate expectations, the Donald Trump election, the geopolitical madness that's going on in the world. But also, you make your own luck. And I think she might have made a bit of her own bad luck. So for Labour, I think, you know, they've kept compounding the errors. My list goes, promise not to raise main taxes. Error number one. Make massive fuss about £22 billion black hole when previously nobody was concerned about the UK's finances. Error number two. Take winter fuel payment off for everyone without having really thought it through properly. Error number three. Raise employer national insurance and claim that that's not really raising national insurance. Error number four. Pension tax raid. Error number five. Benefit bungle to meet fiscal rule ahead of spring statement. They basically rushed out these benefit reforms in order to tick a box in a spreadsheet and meet the fiscal rule. Error number, what were we on? Five, six, can't remember. Crash low-paid jobs market with national insurance rise coming in. Biggest impact has been on the lower paid. U-turn on some of the above and end up in a worse fiscal position because in order to rush through your benefit reforms, you had to promise a little sop to make it look better, but now you've reversed them all, but you've had to keep the bit that you did to make it look better. So it's actually going to cost you more money than if you hadn't just done it in the first place ahead of the spring statement. That is a strong list for a government in its first year of charge that promised to end the chaos. Now, the only thing I would say is I think what we need to do now is we need to start from a kind of like, that's all in the past. We can't do anything about that, right? What we need to do now is we need to move on in a much better fashion. And I think the first thing that could be done is for the government to come clean on some of the stuff that it's rumoured to be planning to do and say, okay, you know, we're going to talk about cash ISAs in a minute. I personally would say, I'm not going to do anything to cash ISAs. It's all rumours and we've decided not to do it. I think that's not what they're going to do. But they need to come out and say, yeah, look, this is what we're going to do. They need to come out and say, we're going to leave pensions alone, or this is what we're going to do to them, and various other things. Because otherwise, we are in for what we're in now, July. We're in for another crazy period like we had last year, ahead of the budget, where people are making wrong-headed financial decisions off the back of rumours of what taxes are going to have to rise. And it's only going to escalate. And they can't do what they did last time, which is just let those rumours continue to swirl because it's damaging for the economy. It's damaging for businesses who are not investing. It's damaging for people because they aren't spending. And it's damaging for people's finances because they're making decisions based on rumour and what they think might happen.
Lee, there's a list there, isn't there? What about the good stuff? We'll get on to taxes and whether they might have to rise in the budget, etc., talking about speculation. But what are the good things?
I can't actually think of anything off the top of my head, Georgie, to
Well,
put
it's
into
funny, Lee, because
the
I
good
asked
things box.
ChatGPT this because I was also struggling. We got real wage growth here. So real take-home pay has risen thanks to a higher minimum wage and public sector pay deals. We got a significant NHS boost, which not really personal finance, but a national wealth fund launched and regulating bailiffs and debt protections. That's what it came up with.
That's a pretty
Do you think it
crap.
was scraping the barrel there a little bit?
That's not, that's not,
ChatGPT was
that
struggling.
doesn't beat Chat Simon in his error list. But I would say with that, Georgie, like some of those things, like the NHS, I mean, you could say, well, more money for the NHS, but where does it all go? Like, is it, yeah, it just feels like a never ending kind of blob of money
Money
just
pit.
never solves anything. We never actually get to the kind of nub of the issue. I know there's been some announcements this week about the doctor in your pocket and all that kind of stuff, trying to stop A&E waiting lists and things, but that's veering out of personal finance. I find it very difficult to kind of come up with a list of personal finance kind of moves that have been
Wins.
beneficial, yeah, for kind of the whole. And actually, I was listening through that list that Simon reeled out there. I think there was maybe 8, 10 things on that list, and I was just nodding along, thinking this is exactly what I would have put on the list. And it has been a turbulent first year, which is unusual when it's a new political party that's come into power. You think the first year is the feel-good factor, the new manager bounce. We're kind of everyone's buzzing. It's exciting. We've changed. They promised us change, but all we've got, it feels like, in the last year, it's just more turbulence. And I think this week I did feel sorry for Rachel Reeves on Wednesday. I don't have much sympathy for politicians on the whole. This is such a tough job. It's so difficult.
That's
And
horrible.
listen, we all have tough days at work where maybe we want to go off and cry, or maybe we have gone off and cried, but we and do it in a private bathroom or somewhere else, like go for a walk and clear your head. Very hard when you're in the public eye like that and there's so much resting on your shoulders. I think the pressure really got to Rachel Reeves this week, and I did feel a degree of sympathy for her because, as Simon says, they're all Keir Starmer's decisions, and it kind of it feels difficult. The welfare U-turn this week has been absolutely seismic. It's obviously caused lots of fractures within the Labour Party already within the first year, which is not a great sign, and it kind of spooked markets a little bit and made yields spike and all that kind of thing. And then so I had a sympathy with her, and then I saw Rachel Reeves on TV yesterday, I think on Sky News. A completely different woman. She looked like she'd had a good night's rest. She looked like she was coming out fighting. And then she kind of really backed herself and sort of, not gloated, but kind of like, I'm doing a great job as Chancellor. And I kind of thought, we've gone from one extreme to another here. And then my sympathy sort of waned a little bit. But again, I was just nodding along to Simon there. And let's not forget that much of this rot did start in the previous government. It did start with the Conservatives, the freezing of tax thresholds. It does not bode, did not bode well. And I would have found it very difficult to accept that Labour would have come in and started, improving the situation on that front. The worrying mood music now, though, is that we're talking about a £40 billion black hole that needs to be plugged. That's the latest. We're doubling the black hole here. And then the Chancellor saying that there's going to be a cost to this week's U-turn on welfare reform, which she said would be reflected in the budget. And as Simon says, please, not another 3 months of flying a billion kites of what's going to stick as tax cuts, what's palatable for people. But I've said this a million times on this podcast. People are just fed up. How much more can we be taxed? How much? What are you going to go after next? We're at a real peak tax. I just can't see. And then they're falling over each other. Talk about stuff like wealth tax that has been proven really around the world not to properly work. It just feels like running out of ideas, and that's not good in now 1 year of a new political party. And I feel like there was a long run up to that election where they could have got a lot more ducks in the row. They could have had a lot more kind of a solid plan. It was quite clear that Labour were going to win the election, I think,
Oh, yeah.
a good few months run up into it. And I'm sure, the discussions must have been when we get to power, this is what, we're going to do. But, even the winter fuel payment stuff, it was just really bungled, wasn't it? The way that that was done, it didn't make any sense straight off the bat. It was just a kind of, not the biggest saving in the world, but it just looked particularly nasty in a world in which, people say, well, the Conservatives are the nasty party. So I think that it's been a strange first year. Strange first season of Labour. Can a new manager bounce second season, get a few loans in? I don't know. It's going to be difficult to now, recapture the confidence of the British public.
Maybe
And
get some new summer signings in.
when that's maybe that's where, do I dare say cabinet reshuffle? I mean, I get the feeling that Rachel Reeves is the Chancellor in for the long haul, famous last words. Because I think if it was all over, I kind of don't think she would have come out all guns blazing yesterday on Thursday, I should say, on Sky News, saying that
But she got the backing of the board, which is always the risky side,
Yeah,
isn't it?
vote of confidence is always the kind of the
how many football analogies can we get in here, Lynn?
it's been at least a few weeks since some football's been on, so yeah.
Exactly. But Lee made a point there about the gilt yields. Bonds moved, UK government bonds, the pound fell on Wednesday after this speech. They've slightly rallied since she got the backing of the board, as it were, since Keir Starmer backed Rachel Reeves as Chancellor. Is that the market's kind of supporting Rachel Reeves? Was it a concern that if she did go, then Labour would have loosened the fiscal rules, spent more, etc., etc.? Like, what's the movement in the bond market telling us?
It's telling us two things, I would suggest. Firstly, it's telling us that the market's conviction that Britain is going to manage to maintain fiscal discipline by cutting spending is not what it was. There is a view that with the U-turn on the welfare stuff, it's just like, oh, they're never going to be able to rein in spending. So the alternative, in order to balance the books, which Rachel Reeves is very committed to doing, and she's got her fiscal rule, is you either change the fiscal rule, which would have been fine if she hadn't made such a fuss about the fiscal rule, or you meet it by continuing to raise taxes. If you can't cut spending, that's how you're going to have to do it. And markets are looking at this and going, raising taxes is not going to deliver any growth. It's going to hamper growth. And the thing that we really need is growth to get money coming in. Okay, we need to, like, there's a certain amount of growth that's just reliant on what is going on in the global economy and what's going on in the world at any given time, right? And at the moment, we're not at a great level. Then there's the can you do better than other countries bit. And at the moment, we're not achieving that. That is what Labour came to power promising that we were going to do. And that is actually what markets believed Labour were going to do. This is why I find the whole £22 billion black hole, 100 days of miserabilism thing so completely baffling, because they came to power on a wave of optimism in the country, a wave of optimism from markets as well, a wave of optimism from business who said, okay, this is great. Like, new government, new broom, they're going to sort stuff out. They're going to be, baseline is competency, right? And then they're going to do some other stuff above that. And unfortunately, that expectation that they can deliver that growth has been eroded away. That expectation that they can get us moving up the table, out of mid-table obscurity and up into the Champions League spots, has, to coin another football analogy, like, disappeared away. Okay, so there's that problem. Then there's that, okay, what are they going to do to do the fiscal rule? Are they going to have to raise taxes? That's an issue because that's pretty much anti-growth. Then you've also got the scenario where markets were looking at this and going, oh, hang on a minute. If she goes, who do we get instead? And it was a vote of confidence in Rachel Reeves, in the sense that it looked for a bit like Rachel Reeves might be going, and they were like, left-wing chancellor, who's going to take over? What could we get? And I actually still think that Rachel Reeves has got it in her to be a really good chancellor. They look at it and they went, you know, she's the best we're going to get. The alternatives are not great from the perspective of the markets. I mean, I don't know who the alternatives would be, but, you know, one alternative, for example, Torsten Bell, former head of the Resolution think tank, got some very strong views on wealth, inheritance, a man whose think tank proposed a limit on the overall amount you could have in a cash ISA over, you know, not just what you can put in, but what you could have in there overall, who would be very pro more taxes on wealth, more taxes on inheritance, things like that. He would be a strong contender. I don't know who else you might get. I mean, you could get a Wes Streeting, I suppose. He would probably be more in the mould of a Rachel Reeves. Angela Rayner as Chancellor. Wow, that would be a big one, wouldn't it? I don't think it's going to happen, but, you know, big Ange as Chancellor could definitely upset the markets. And then it now looks like Rachel Reeves is going to stay as Chancellor. And so these things have ebbed away a bit. Markets have calmed down and gone, actually, do you know what? It's probably all right for now. But there's still that little bit of extra premium that we're going to have to pay on our borrowing, because they don't quite believe that we're going to be able to achieve the fiscal discipline that we said we're going to achieve without raising taxes again. And they see that as a bad thing.
Lee, Torsten Bell. It's a name that is familiar because I read it today in your newsletter related to the cash ISA. Why are we talking about this? Because it looks very likely that July the 15th, after much speculation, is going to be the date when we find out exactly what's going to happen to Casha Isis. Rachel Reeves is going to give a speech, the Mansion House speech. What are we going to hear, Lee?
I'm not going to tread over this too much because we have spoken about this a lot on the podcast, and this is an absolute glowing example of what Simon was mentioning earlier about the speculation and just months of speculation. Rather than just coming out and saying this is what we're doing, it's just led to, absolutely tens of thousands of column inches dedicated to Casha Isis. I mean, I'm not being funny, Georgie, but when you see Isis trending on Twitter for 2 days in a row, I mean, I'd never thought I'd see the day. I mean, people are actually really quite interested in this. And actually, 82% of our readers that took part in a poll said that the tinkering of the Casha Isis allowance would basically upset them. They wouldn't like it at all. All right, so let me just quickly rattle through this. So you get a £20,000 ISA allowance every new financial year. At the moment, you can blend that between cash ISA and the stocks and shares ISA, how you see fit. There's a couple of other more niche ISA products that I won't get into, but for most people, they have a cash ISA or a stocks and shares ISA, or blend the two. Me personally, I do 75% in a stocks and shares ISA and 25% in a cash ISA. I'm not in a position to max out the £20,000 limit, but I do have friends and family that can max out that £20,000 a year limit. And it's crucial for people, especially if you're a higher rate taxpayer or an additional rate taxpayer, because essentially, if you're a higher rate taxpayer, you can only earn £500 of savings interest without being taxed. And for additional rate taxpayers, they have a zero personal savers allowance. That means that ISA is effectively the second cornerstone, I would say, of most people's personal finances now. The first being private pension and making sure that you're tucking enough away in that. But a cash ISA or an ISA in general is just more at arm's reach. Your pension's locked away until you're old and grey. That's the whole point of, your retirement pot. For an ISA, it's at arm's reach if you really need it. You don't really want to take it out of that tax-free wrapper, but it's still within arm's reach if you need it. It has become a victim of its own success, seemingly, because it's now under attack, and it looks very likely that the cash ISA element of it, under the pretense that Rachel Reeves wants people to invest more, will be slimmed down to take your pick. £10,000 is one rumored limit, £5,000 is another, and the one that's probably been battered around the most is £4,000. That means that this financial year, with a £20,000 ISA allowance, could be worth 5 years' worth if it gets down to £4,000. For that reason, and we have said this, I have said this on the podcast before the data and the stats came out, it was going to shift behavior. Again, going back to what Simon was saying, people making decisions based on speculation. And what I think people are doing is focusing way more on the cash ISA element of their ISA wrapper, rather, even if they usually invest, because they're thinking, well, this is a last chance to, basically cash stuff my ISA. I can invest £20,000 next year because that looks like it's not off the cards. That doesn't look like it's off the table. So people are sticking a lot of money into ISA. Since Rachel Reeves became Chancellor, £50 billion has gone into cash ISAs. In April, there was £14 billion that went into cash ISAs. That is a record. And then there was a further almost £4 billion in May. So £18 billion in 2 months. That's a massive, massive shift in habit. Huge compared to comparison months in years gone by. Clearly, people are panicking that they're not going to be able to stick money into cash. And listen, I believe in investing. I believe in stocks and shares ISAs. I believe that over the long term, it is a better home for your cash. I also believe in the power of a cash ISA because it's a good way to sort money away. The conversation I've had with the handful of friends and family that I know that are in a fortunate enough position to be able to max out their ISA, they're all doing the same thing. They're maxing out their cash ISA for the first time and are just completely avoiding investing for the next year. Whether that's the correct strategy or not, well, the jury is out. But I understand the premise behind it and why people are doing it. Because if next year, in the financial year 25, sorry, in the financial year 26, 27, if you can only put £4,000 into a cash ISA, I say only, if you could put £4,000 into cash ISA and the rest of your allowance must go into stocks and shares ISA, you can see why people are thinking it. Now, look, the fundamental thing I don't understand about this, and Simon and I were talking about this in the office this week, how Rachel Reeves is going to encourage people who usually save. They much rather save than invest because they see investing as risky, even though the data out there shows 5 year, 10 year term, investing usually beats saving. But the whole thing is about putting more money into British stocks to back more British businesses. Where's the incentive to do that with this potential? Maybe we'll find out at the Mansion House speech. Maybe there's going to be something. When we had the whole British ISA thing that fell flat, but it feels like something has to happen if you are encouraging people to back British instead of going global, because we are hardwired to spread risk, not putting all your eggs in one basket. The other thing I would say as well, I'm a man in my 30s. I have the appetite for investment risk. There's a lot of people, older people, that use ISAs in their 40s, 50s, 60s, who just have no appetite to invest, and perhaps did invest once upon a time, and a part of their kind of retirement strategy now is to not invest and rather be in a cash ISA. So for all of those reasons, I think that this move is a bit bananas, and the months and months that this has gone on is just, it's been completely blown out of proportion, and it never needed to be this way.
Simon, just briefly, can you make the case for us? Let's do the junior debating society where you have to make the case of the thing that you don't quite believe in. Can you make sense of this? Are they trying, if not to get us more investing, they're thinking, well, even if we don't invest, we might spend a bit more so we can have a bit more consumer growth, or the fact that they might get more money in tax from savings? I mean, what's the reason? Because I haven't actually spoken to anyone who seems to think this is a good idea.
Well, there are some people who think it's a good idea. There are some people lobbying for this change. They tend to be in the investment industry, and it looks a little bit self-interested, if I'm going to be entirely honest. The case that they are making is that if you are going to give people a tax break, then they should be encouraged to back the UK stock market with that tax break. Now, it is true that quite a lot of ISA money actually goes into gigantic American corporations. And I don't really think that we need to cut cash ISAs in order for more people to buy Amazon shares or Meta shares. I think, even if they're doing it through a tracker fund. However, people do have home bias. If you look at their ISA holdings, they do tend to hold roughly kind of 40% UK stocks. And that is usually through investing in UK funds, rather than investing in individual UK shares. So it is true that a decent chunk of ISA money that is invested goes into those companies. So that it's not entirely baseless, this suggestion, but it does look very self-interested. And you will find that people are so affected by tax. So capital gains tax rates have gone up, capital gains tax allowances have gone down. You can only make £3,000 a year worth of profit, whereas previously, before Jeremy Hunt got let loose, you could make £12,300, and Labour has since raised the capital gains tax rates. People are also feeling the squeeze in many other ways, in tax, as I discussed earlier in the podcast. So you will find that some of those people who could afford to put £20,000 into an ISA, which means that you've got quite a lot of money, right, would probably, if the cash element was cut, put some more money into investment ISAs. And even if they put more money into their investment ISA and then leave it sitting in cash, which a lot of people do, that at least it would be in a place where they could then invest it, right? So it will make a bit of a difference. That's my argument for it. My argument against it is this is a stupid idea. Okay, there used to be a different stocks and shares ISA limit and cash ISA limit. It used to be that you could put it all into a stocks and shares, or you could only put a certain amount into cash. We got rid of that because it was a bad system. Why we would go back to a system that was considered to be a bad system, I am absolutely mystified. The idea that more of this money will go into investments, I think, is complete nonsense. If you really want to get people to take advantage of their tax-free allowance and put it into the UK stock market, then the British ISA was a better idea than this, because it was giving people a chunk of ISA allowance that had to go into the UK stock market. Even then, that was riddled with problems. There was the like, okay, what about investment trusts? They're listed on the stock market. And what about if it's a global investment trust? Does that count? What about ETFs? Do they count? Are we encouraging people to be too exposed to the UK stock market when actually we should be encouraging them to use their money in a sensible way, which is to spread their money around the world? Okay. I also think that the other big problem with this is that it undermines trust in the system. Why would you take your most successful saving and investing product, the one that everybody believes in, the one that people trust, and undermine it by tinkering with the rules? What you should do is you should make ISAs better, not make them worse. Come up with a way that is more seamless to move between cash and investing. And if you talk to some companies that have managed to achieve that, some of the app-based companies, then that's what they say. They say, well, yeah, people do open a cash ISA, but then they do shift to stocks and shares ISAs. And it's about trying to take away the boundary between the two, not increase it, right? That's what you need to do to get people to be investing. And you need to educate them. It needs to be, look, you might think that your 4% is good, but actually you're going to, over the long term, you'll lose out to inflation. And also about saying to them, it's not all or nothing. It's not, black or white. It's not one end of the spectrum, the other end of the spectrum. It is a spectrum. You can just basically, if you are more happy in cash, that's fine. But I tell you what, you've got your £20,000 in cash. Maybe try putting £1,000 into investments. See if you like it. See if it works out. If it doesn't work out, fine. But you've only tried it with £1,000. But if it does work out and you do like it, maybe you could try 2,000. Maybe you could try 3,000. It's doing that thing where you get people to shift their mindset a little bit along the line. And the other thing I would say is the problem with undermining trust here is that basically what will happen, and I've seen this, I've seen like 20 years of reader comments on stories. What's the point in putting my money into a pension? They'll only go and change the rules and grab it for tax, usually followed by some kind of comment about Gordon Brown in the past, now followed by some comment about either the Tories, who are the raging left as far as many readers are concerned, or Rachel Reeves nowadays, basically is what it's going to be. But that would be the same with ISIS. It'll be like, well, yeah, what's the point though? I could put my money in a stocks and shares ISA, but they'll only change the rules. They did a tax grab on cash ISAs, they'll do it on stocks and shares ISAs next. So you need to build trust in the system, not undermine the system. So that's why I wouldn't do this. I hope they don't.
It looks pretty likely, doesn't it, though? Simon shrugging his shoulders there.
I've just remembered that doesn't really work on a
It
podcast,
doesn't
does it?
work on a
It's just like a
podcast.
shrug your shoulders and
But
pull a meh face.
yeah, a
Yeah, okay.
brilliant comedy downturn of your mouth there. But
For the
yes,
benefit of
there
the
is.
listeners, I was shrugging my shoulders and going, meh, but without
Who
saying the
knows?
word, meh.
Who knows? Who knows? One thing, I don't want to go too much into the speculation. Going to have a lot of this coming up between now and the budget. But has there, Lee, been anything that you've been hearing, any whisperings of what might be looked at? I mean, where, like you said earlier, where can you tax anymore? They've already come out and said, I think, no to workers' tax. So they're still committing to that, not raising VAT, a national insurance, or income tax. But, they said that last time and they raised national insurance on businesses, and that didn't go down too well, did it?
It could come from anywhere, Georgie. I mean, honestly, there could be even more of an inheritance grab. There could be, I wouldn't even say private pensions are off the table. Things like fuel duty has been frozen for a long time. I get the impression that everything is on the table, other than the things you just mentioned, and the fiscal rule stuff. Will that stick? It's hard to predict. But the thing is, Georgie, what's happened during this podcast is that I'm now filled with dread. Because I realized that we are coming up to somehow it's a kind of budget, like not that far away. I mean, I say it's sort of 3 months away, but
We're here before we know it, Lee.
it's gonna be weeks and weeks and weeks of speculation. And they have to. I personally, if I was advising Rachel Reeves and the Labour Party, is to just chop down the speculation and just be very black and white. Yes, we are looking at this and might do it like that. No, this is not going to be touched whatsoever. Otherwise, we're going to be in a similar position that we were in the run-up to the last budget when people were making rash decisions. And it's just very unstable for people's personal finances. So my answer is expect the unexpected and also expect the expected.
That's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Lisa Kaplan of Charles Stanley Direct for our weekly Investing Explained feature. Lisa, a topical question. How much cash savings should I hold before I start investing?
It's a good question. The classic line that we use is 3 to 6 months of expenditure, but it varies a lot. So think in your head, what position would you be in if you lost your job tomorrow? You had no income coming in. You want to be sure that you can pay your mortgage, pay your rent, or feed your family, and that sort of thing. So that's what's behind the 3 to 6 months. But it varies. For instance, if you're self-employed, you may want to hold more. I would also say if you've got some expenditure coming up in the near future, and perhaps even 1 or 2 years away, you'd want to keep that in cash. So, for instance, many people have a tax bill due at the end of July. Obviously, you'd want that available and you would keep that in cash. So it's not the same for everybody. Give it some thought, but at least 3 to 6 months worth of expenditure.
Welcome back. What to do with a problem like the state pension? It's expensive. It costs $145.6 billion a year, according to the latest official statistics, or about 55% of welfare spend. Think tank, the Institute for Fiscal Studies, has some ideas, including ditching the triple lock eventually, but it's urging the government to keep means testing off the table. Simon, why do anything with the state pension? What's wrong with it? Except it's expensive.
Well, it's obviously expensive because we pay it to lots of people and we've made it better in recent years. So it is a cost. And unfortunately, the problem with the state pension is that there is this belief that people have paid in national insurance contributions and that's gone into a pot that's going to cover their pension in the future. And that's not true. Basically, what pays the pensions of people getting their pension now is the people who are working at the moment. And then the people who are working at the moment hope that there's going to be some more people coming in at the bottom in order to pay them when they get their money, and so on and so on and so on. It does sound a bit like a pyramid scheme, I must admit. The problem with this pyramid is that it's the wrong way up as well, and that there's more older people in the older generations due to baby booms than there are in the younger generations who are working and paying the money in, so that it's getting increasingly expensive at the same time as it's getting harder to cover the costs. The statistics there are not directly comparable, by the way. I'm using that as a figure of speech, so please don't email in and send me demographic data saying that there's actually more people. There's obviously more people of working age than there are of pension age. I think that's true, actually. Just painting myself into a corner here. Look, the point is, it's expensive because there's lots of old people and the pension's got better, right? Okay. And there's working people who are paying for it. The other problem is we keep tinkering with the bloody thing, right? So you've got the triple lock, right? Actually, ironically, we haven't tinkered with the triple lock. We've left the triple lock alone. But the triple lock was a bit of tinkering in order to try to make the pension better. And it has made the pension substantially better, but it has also made the pension substantially more expensive. And this is a problem that is only going to continue. That then leads to the whole, like, well, they're going to have to means test pensions. Actually, we're not that far off the state pension, even if you only got state pension income, ending up being taxed. Because tax thresholds are frozen and the pension's going up, and it's going to go, those two lines are going to cross at some point. At which point, you're going to be back in the situation of that slightly mad thing of giving people money and taking money back off them, which always looks a bit sort of not so sensible until you realize that actually there's loads of places where we do this and that's just the way life works. But anyway, what the IFS has said is that it would be a very good idea to lay out some rules of the plan for the state pension and what we will do and what we won't do, and then stick to them and get some form of cross-party support for this with an enduring promise that this is what we will do and this is what we won't do. Now, I must say, that does sound like quite a sensible plan.
Lee, what do you make of all of this, though? Why not means test it? What should you do instead?
The IFS, I do think they do actually come up with quite sensible ideas and kind of reports and things, because this is something that is bubbling away. That is the very epitome of kicking the can down the road, a problem for another decade type of thing. And it's very difficult to shake out of your mind. It's that common, like, down the pub chat, isn't it? Yeah, well, maybe not amongst some people, but
Normal people.
yeah, but will the state pension always be there? You know, in retirement, will you, as someone potentially in your 20s, 30s, 40s, be able to rely on state pension to make up part of your retirement? Or will it be means tested? I think that is quite a common thing that people do talk about. And lots of people also of pension age do talk about the payments being quite measly and not being fair enough. And that's despite this, the triple lock having been utilized for quite a long time and, as Simon says, has improved where we're at. But in this IFS report, there was some devil in the detail in there that I was looking at, sort of poring over the pages. And one of them said, at a current trajectory, by 2068, 69, the retirement age would need to be 74 in order for the state pension system to still be working if the triple lock remained in place. And that means essentially if you were born in the 90s, you, or the mid to late 90s, you might not potentially get your state pension until 74. That's what the IFS was laying out in this report. And that, I think, should worry people and should make people think, to wrestle hold of your own private pension and your own retirement. And as we always say on this as well, if you're self-employed, look into getting SIP. So the proposals that they're saying in here, they're talking about the reforms, getting cross-party support, all that kind of thing, is just so difficult. But if you think about it, this is such a huge cost and it's such a huge part of people's lives, that really there does we can't carry on just not having the awkward conversation. I would argue that within 1 year of being in power, it's probably not something that you should be looking into. This is more of a kind of a little bit more further down the line. But what the IFS is saying this is some of the things that it's saying. The government should choose a target level for the state pension, set as a percentage of average earnings in the wider economy, and keep using the triple lock to decide annual increases until it is reached. After that, it would be hiked in line with average earnings growth or inflation if that is higher. Currently, the state pension is worth 30% of median, meaning the middle value, not average full-time earnings. And it said the state pension age is currently 66, and between 2026 and 2028, it will rise to 67. But the next rise to 68 is still up in the air. The IFS says it should only rise as longevity and older ages rises, but by less than that, meaning the average time spent receiving the state pension would increase. And also said here, auto-enrollment into work pensions should be charged, so employers have to put at least 3% into a pension for every staff member, even if they're not making minimum contributions themselves. That last one is the onus on having your own private pension and making sure that you're on track and not being heavily reliant on a state pension, which, I'm not saying everyone in this current generation, but there are a lot of people who currently just solely exist on the state pension. And if you're just solely existing on the state pension, that does look measly. You know, that is a sum of money to live on. That is not easy whatsoever. And that's why there has been strides towards us taking more control of our retirement and how it looks, and not to be overly reliant on a state pension if you want to have a good quality retirement.
Are we likely to get anything on pensions soon, Simon, do you reckon?
Yes, the government's going to do like a pension adequacy review. I think there's a plan that Rachel Reeves is going to announce this in her Mansion House speech. The government has committed to doing something on pensions and making pensions better. So, this is why these ideas are coming out now. And there's been some various other ideas. Some of the stuff about helping people to build emergency pots as well alongside their pension, emergency pots that they can access are good. What I think is good in here is this: we need to change the triple lock. We need to make sure pensions are decent, and then we change the triple lock. I think that's a good idea. But also this stuff about improving auto enrollment, minimum contributions, employer contributions, the self-employed as well, getting them to contribute to pensions. Because I think there's a temptation to look at auto enrollment as a great success and then sit on our hands and go, yeah, pat ourselves on the back. Look, we did something good there, didn't we? And we did do something good there. And there should be pats on the back. But we need to keep ratcheting it up, because you're in a scenario where we are in the shift from people having defined benefit pensions, where their employer was responsible for their retirement income, to defined contribution pensions where people are responsible for their own retirement income. And that is the case for most private sector workers nowadays. But you've still got private sector workers retiring with chunks of defined benefit pension that they built up before their workplace stopped the defined benefit pension. Now you've got people in the public sector who've got defined benefit pensions and are still getting them, and that's great. But you've got people opting out of those because they're saying they can't afford their contributions, because in order to get that defined benefit, contribution, you might be having to put in 10% of your salary, for example. Now it's great because your employer's putting in, like, they work, it's weird, they basically tell you the equivalent of your salary that they're putting in, even though actually what they're doing is then just promising to give you a certain amount in retirement anyway. So it kind of doesn't matter. It's like, it's just on them to sort that out. But yeah, it's like, you look at the numbers, it's like 20, 20%, 25%, people's salaries going in, but people are passing that up because they're saying, well, my contribution is unaffordable. So you need to make sure that those public sector workers are making the contributions that mean they're doing it. We probably need to have a very, honest conversation about whether we can continue to support defined benefit pensions in the public sector. I wouldn't want to see a race to the bottom, though, and that's what my concern would be, is that we go, oh, well, we can't afford that, so everyone's going to get the bad system, rather than trying to achieve the good system, everybody gets the bad system. But I do think this stuff about ratcheting up auto enrollment and not just going, oh yeah, we did a good thing and let's sit back, is that we need to do that. And then, it is an extra cost on employers, but frankly, employers have benefited from a bit of an easy ride on pensions over the last 10, 15, 20 years compared to what they used to do. Maybe we do need to push a bit of this back onto them.
Yes, indeed, Simon. Right, finally, structural problems, bad smells, clutter, shoddy entrance, lack of curb appeal are the main reasons homes fail to sell. Now, that's according to two property experts. There is a premiere, a new premiere of a new Channel 4 TV show called Can't Sell, Must Sell. Scarlett and Stuart Douglas have shared some of their horror stories with This Is Money and told us what they fixed to get the property sold. Lee, bad smells, clutter, shoddy entrance, lack of curb appeal. I can absolutely agree with that. Oh, yes.
I think those five things are nailed on. I think they actually probably are the five things that I would name. And having currently go through a house hunting process and a house selling process, I think actually the one that people really trip over, literally, clutter is the one. Honestly, it's really hard. And we've had loads of viewings on our house over recent weeks. And when you've got two young children, trying to sort of shove away all the clutter, it is not a simple task. It is not easy. And actually, it's hard because we've been viewing houses as well, and you kind of know that they're in the same position. They've been tucking their clutter away into sort of wardrobes and, like, lofts. And at one point, a couple of weeks ago, I had to put some of the clutter from the house into the car because I ran out of time to put the clutter away. And what the thing is with the clutter is that if it looks like you haven't got enough storage space to put things, it can put people off. Now, it isn't an easy endeavor, I would say, especially with children, as I've come to find out. And that, to be honest, it's part of the reason why we're trying to move house. But that is a must thing. I agree with your lack of curb appeal as well. You don't want to be buying a house that just looks ugly from the outside. And when we've been house hunting, there's some I've just ruled out because I just do not like the look of the house whatsoever. And bad smells, honestly, it's hard to override that because you're probably thinking, well, I'm going to have to replace all the carpet or hard flooring. If there's been pets, for example, smelly dog smell, difficult to get out. I would say back in the day, it was probably smoking, but lots of people don't smoke anymore, and their houses probably smell like bubble gum vape or whatever it is that people have. So it's probably quite nice. So just flipping this around, actually. So this Channel 4 program started on Wednesday. I've watched this pair, actually. They had another program. They know what they're doing. They know what they're talking about. And at the bottom of this article that we've done is the three tips to get a house sold. And the first one is highlight the positives. Now, what I've done with the estate agent, and Georgie, you're probably not going to be surprised to hear this, I do have a laminated A4 sheet of selling the house that I think that the estate agent would quite likely miss out if I didn't tell them. This includes that the boiler is under 5 years old. It includes that we had the conservatory roof replaced, so it's no longer plastic and is an actual usable glass. It includes that we have a water softener system within the house. All the little bits and pieces that make the house actually sing and justify the price point that quite often the estate agent might not point out or might forget, because let's face it, they're going around from home to home trying to sell them, and it's quite easy to forget. So I thought actually just having a laminated sheet with the selling points was quite an ingenious idea, if a little bit sad, but I don't care. Number two is good photos taken. Now, I had the photos taken and I shifted all the boxes of clutter from downstairs upstairs while they took the pictures of downstairs, and then I moved it all downstairs from upstairs when they took the pictures of upstairs. The pictures that came back made me want to buy the house. The photo, absolutely incredible. And I sent it to my mum, and my mum is literally like the least enthusiastic person you can ever imagine. Everything is just, yeah, it's all right, it's average, yeah, whatever. I sent her the pictures and she was like, wow, if your house looked like that all the time, you should just live there. And I was in agreement. And then, I've been house hunting. Some of the photography of some of the estate agents is absolutely shocking. I was looking at one the other day. It was taken from sort of the strangest angles. And there was clearly some poor Photoshop in it, because some of their walls looked like it looked like a crooked house, and it was like it wasn't like an old house. It was so bizarre. So having good photos is key. But I think the number one thing is price your home sensibly. If you're going to price people out of your home or come up with silly sums of money that you're asking for your home without knowing the local market, looking around what else is selling of a similar sort of stature, but also playing to your strengths. So thinking about, you know, if you are close to a train station in a commuter town, that's really important. Being close to good schools, you have to really make sure that you price your home sensibly. If you don't, it's just going to be sat languishing on the market, and the estate agent is simply going to kind of turn around to you after a few months ago. You're going to have to lower the price. And really, you do not want to be going down that line. Buyers have a lot of information at their fingertips, and they can see also what's going on in the local market, and they can see actually also that you've reduced the price of your house, which isn't really ideal. I think it's an interesting article. I think it's very good, and you know, lots of sensible advice in there. There's also lots of things when you are buying a home that you shouldn't be put off by. You shouldn't be put off by clutter, because, you know, you've got to be able to visualize what you can do to the house. You shouldn't be put off by things like bad decor. It doesn't take much to, you know, change a room's sort of vibe, its lighting, its color, you know, all of that kind of stuff. You have to look at the bigger picture.
I was making notes, Lee, as you were talking there. Curb appeal, Simon, has two things for me. When I first read it, I was like, dropped curbs. So I live on a street where you may have a curb, you may not, you may park. It's completely random. Luckily, we have a drop curb, but it's next door neighbour has a right nightmare. Curb appeal, there's a house a couple of doors down that's got a rotting caravan right in front of the house. It just makes the whole street look really nasty. So I've written neighbours again, nothing you can do about that. But there are things in terms of shower pressure. I know Lee's wife is a big fan of, well, testing for the shower, but Wi-Fi. Why didn't I check it before I bought this place? It's got zero, not Wi-Fi, zero mobile reception. You'd think I live in Timbuktu or something. Those are my issues, Simon.
Dropped curb appeal. That's a good one.
That's it.
Dropped curb appeal? Depending on where you live, dropped curb appeal can be a major appeal. It's funny what Lee said there about the clutter and the photos. When we sold our flat in London, we spent like a year trying to sell it. It was 2019, Brexit chaos year. Nobody wanted to buy houses. Everybody's really worried about buying houses. The market was totally dead. In that year, our house was permanently decluttered. The clutter had gone, not into the car, fortunately. Otherwise, we'd have been having to move it out of the car back into the house every time we wanted to go somewhere. But it was in a storage unit. And I must admit, I loved that year in our flat. It was one of the best years. I didn't love the bills from the storage unit, which storage is so expensive. But yeah, I reckon the first years in that flat where you've got the novelty, and then the final year in that flat where we didn't have like half the crap, was amazing. It was absolutely brilliant. It was permanently tidy. It was permanently uncluttered.
Yeah, makes such a difference.
Because you weren't just constantly falling over stuff and going, where am I going to put this? And yeah, the photos look great. But it was an unrealistic way of living. The other thing I would say is that actually I do agree. I love Lee's laminated sheet, but I do agree with that thing of like sell the home and the area to the people who are buying, especially if they don't know the area, because that's like a major selling point for people. The fact that you might have a great local pub that you can walk to and take. The fact that there might be a lovely park down the road. The fact that, like, what do you do at the weekends? You go off and, like, you can get to the countryside really quickly. You can go for a walk, or you can get into town really quickly. There's these great shops, and actually, it's got a really good high street. It's one of the places that's still got a good high street. Or, do you know what's brilliant about living here? You can jump on the train, you can be in London or the nearest major city in 30 minutes. Yet, when you get back here, you just feel like you've like left it all behind. Now, don't follow your buyers. Potential buyers around the house in their ear all the time. We talked about this a few weeks ago, didn't we, with the wife who was doing that. But if you've got interest, if you've got a second viewing or something like that, or you do have that opportunity, or even if you do just like, you know what, it doesn't hurt for them to have an A4 sheet of paper that just says, this is the great stuff about living here. Because like the estate agent doesn't necessarily know that. They can try and give a little bit of that stuff, and sometimes they will give the patter. But the people who are going to be buying your home are most likely to be a bit like you. If you're selling a one bedroom flat because you've grown out of it to first time buyers, like you would have probably been a first time buyer when you bought it and you loved it for a reason. If you're selling a three bedroom house, you know, because you need a bigger house because your family's growing. What's going to probably happening is someone who's 5 years behind you in the family stakes is moving in. All those things. Yeah, tell them that. Tell them that. And increase the emotional appeal, not just the curb appeal, but the emotional appeal.
Right, Simon, stat of the week.
All right, stat of the week. 3.7%. That is how much the average home has risen by since 2016, according to wealth manager Rathbones, which says that although we think that house prices always go up, and we actually feel that they have gone up quite a lot and they're very unaffordable, since 2016, it claims that the price of residential property has risen at an average of 3.7% per year and barely kept up with inflation. The stock market, on the other hand, the UK stock market, which has not been the world's greatest performer since 2016 and is generally looked down upon and not in a way that people look at house prices, that has risen by an average of 7% a year. So £100
Goodness.
invested in UK property in 2016 would be worth £134 in 2024. So it's to the end of last year. Whereas the same amount invested in a portfolio of UK and international stocks would have risen to £174. You
Good
can't live in the
stat.
stock market, though.
You can't. That is very true. Thank you very much, Simon. Thank you, Lee. That is it for this week. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or, of course, download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team, anything you'd like them to look into, Simon?
You can email us podcast@thisismoney.co.uk and come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all podcasts past and join in the debate in reader comments.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach, or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.